Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a higher performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everybody, to the next edition of State of Readiness. Your host here is Joseph Paris, and with me today I have Peter Evans. And Peter and I have known each other for, you know, several years, and he's the Global Continuous Improvement Director at Lego, one of my favorite companies ever since I was a little kid. I'm sure that everybody in our audience, our listening audience, is familiar with Lego. As adults, of course, we come to be less fans of them as we step on them in the middle of the night. But I understand that, or I saw that Lego had actually created or invented some slippers which would prevent the infliction of pain as you stumble around in the evening and discover these little bricks. Welcome aboard there, Peter.
Thank you, Joseph. It's fantastic to get the opportunity to chat. And as you say, we've known each other for quite a long time.
Yeah,
we actually have a very good group called, they're called AFOLs, Adult Followers of Lego, and are huge followers of ours. And some of our great innovations come from that group.
I bet. I mean, you've seen, you know, you have Legoland, okay, so, and yep. And of course you have all these different models that people invent and build, and you know, I saw one that some child knocked over. It was like $15,000 worth of Legos that they knocked over, and that's, of course, a tragedy. But the nice thing about Legos is you could rebuild them, right?
Exactly, that's the whole point, right? And the big thing is clutch power, though. So their ability to stick together is the thing that we really measure ourselves on from a manufacturing point of view, and that's we worry a lot about that stuff.
So you've only been with Lego for a couple of years. Your journey before Lego brought you through a variety of businesses and industries, right? I mean, you were at GE, and I saw Maersk. And Vodafone, I believe, and one of the Virgin companies. So, you know, how did you get or embark on your CI journey? I mean, what was the impetus? What was the...
It's been an interesting and really, I think, fortuitous journey. But I originated working back in finance, and originally in product costing, and then in credit and risk. I moved to a company that was eventually bought by GE Capital in the early 90s, a company called Avis Fleet, and was running credit and risk there. We managed to merge three companies together, and it went pretty well in my part of the business. So they started to ask me to work on other areas. I took over a fairly disastrous situation in payables for a while, got that fixed. And at the end of that, I was asked if I'd like to pick up a quality role. And in those days, BS 5000 or whatever it was, 5700 or whatever it was called, and ISO 9000, started that, and then GE Capital bought us. And that was a really, really lucky thing for me, I think. Finally working for a company who really took change and improvement seriously. And I was, again, extremely fortunate, right place, right time. I ended up on some pan-European projects for them, spent some time in Brussels, and then was given a job in Brussels running operations across Europe, looking at improvement opportunities, learning incredible stuff for me. I didn't even know there were methodologies at that time, so change acceleration process, workout, some of those things. And then, of course, Six Sigma came along, and that was a classic case of being in the right place at the right time. So I was in the office on a Friday evening. My boss came in and said, there's a meeting in Connecticut on Monday. Would you like to go to it? It's about quality. I turned up, and there was a video of Jack Welch just out of hospital telling everybody he was better and that we were going for Six Sigma. And that was kind of me embarking on a very serious journey then into continuous improvement, and blew my brain at first, but absolutely loved it. And I've been in that journey now for nearly 30 years.
And what did you do at Maersk?
So at Maersk, I looked after what was called process excellence for Northern Europe. And we were at that time working within the commercial division, really, helping with a whole bunch of things across Northern Europe. So everything from Russia to Ireland, and traveling around, helping with process improvement, and doing quite a lot of work with our support centers out in India, Mumbai, principally. Working with those guys, had a fabulous time at Maersk. The shame was that some decisions were taken that we didn't really need process excellence in the regions anymore. It was more focused in India. I was offered a program role and didn't really want to do that, and was very lucky again because some ex-colleagues from Maersk ended up in LEGO, and that's how I ended up here.
And so that's your introduction into LEGO was through your connections and experience at Maersk.
Yeah. Okay. And having had an amazing experience working for a Danish company, despite what we've seen on Fox News over the last few days, fantastic place to work, great ethos in terms of the way that it looks after its people, the way they care about the people around them and the way they work, and absolutely love that. So I'm very, very fortunate to still be in a Danish company, somewhat different company now, but very fortunate, I think, to be working in LEGO. My wife calls it a gift at the end of my career. I tell her sometimes it's a lot harder work than she thinks it is, but it's a great place to be.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, I would guess that almost every kid that's ever played with Legos would have, you know, working for Lego to be like, you know, a dream job. But yeah. you go at great lengths to talk about how the company cares about its people. Mm. So can you dive into that a little bit?
Well, I think the first thing is to remember that Lego is a family business. And the family is very, very close to this business. And the family ethos is very important to us. So we care about some very important things here. We care about the well-being of the people who work here. We look after them very well in terms of just general ways of working. You know, people do not work the hours sometimes you see in Anglo-American businesses in this business, but we get a heck of a lot done and we do it very efficiently. And people feel good being here. I, you know, many of my colleagues have been here a long time, love coming to work, love being amongst their people, and are very, very productive. So it's a really nice place to be. And on top of that, the canteens are good. I don't have to eat pie and chips every time I go for lunch. So that's a big improvement on life.
Yeah, but you live in the UK, right?
I do. I live in Mid Wales, yeah, okay. In the middle of the countryside.
So you go all the way to Denmark just for lunch? Is that what it is?
I do. Absolutely. That's the only reason I come here. Okay. There's not enough fish in Wales, so I have to come to Denmark.
Yeah. You know, it was, I pick up on the way people speak and in the precise words that they use. And I noticed several times that you talk about we. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't talk about they, or you don't talk about Lego. You refer to Lego as if you are in fact part of that family.
Absolutely, and I think that's a very vital part of the ethos and the way we work here. And I take it very personally when customers are upset with us. I take it very personally when our internal customers are upset with us. And we concentrate very hard on making sure that we look after the people around us in the same way as you would your family. And people expect and get respect, and they respect you back. So that's a very, very nice environment to work in.
So some of the things that, you know, it's got to be challenging, you know, making changes or invoking changes, because, you know, I follow Lego, you know what I mean, as I follow most big companies, and, you know, they've had some challenges over the years, you know, some things that, you know, succeeded and some things that, you know, ventures that didn't succeed. I mean, you know, they had the video games and then the movies, of course, so it's not just about bricks anymore. It's, you know, it's a, you know, multimedia, if you will.
It is, but it is all about the brick. So it's a very interesting philosophy, I think. And you're right, in 2003-04, Lego nearly went bust. Family were struggling to keep the company afloat and trying to decide what to do with it. But through a number of very good decisions, not least of all getting Jürgen V to run the company on a day-to-day basis, we turned the corner from that to getting really focused. And what we got focused on was the brick and how important that was and how important the quality of that was to our customers. And on the back of that, everything, as you will see, is based around that very simple construct. Now, we go to very big lengths to make sure that that brick is perfect for everybody and that the kits that they buy and the games that they buy and everything else, every other experience that they have with us is as perfect, but it all comes from the brick. And that I don't see changing. What changes, I think, is our ability in the modern world to connect digital to physical. So how can we make the physical experience more digital or interact with digital? And how, when people are in digital, how can we bring it back from there so that when they see a film or when they play a game, the first thing that our customers want to do is pick up a box of bricks and go make it themselves. And the educational aspects of that and the growth aspects of that are so massive, so mind-developing, that it gives us a unique place, I think, in really in history. If you think about the Western world and anything from the mid-50s onwards, then Lego and the brick has been one of the ways that we've learned and played all the way along.
I also read that they want to, they're very environmentally conscious, and they want to move away from petroleum-based bricks in the very near future.
Yep. Our first sets are out, actually. So all of the items, so the greenery that we sell, if you like, the plants and the trees and all those things now are made from bio materials, so from plant-based plastics. They're not, it's very important to know, they're not biodegradable, so they're still plastic. They still have a long longevity, but they're not made from ground resources, so it's not from things like petrochemicals. And that's the change. We have a lab here in Billund in Denmark where people are working very hard, and we think over the next 10 years or so that all of our bricks will be made from renewable materials, and therefore our impact on the globe, what we call our planet promise, will be delivered.
But they're still not going to be biodegradable, is what I heard.
Not biodegradable as it stands. I don't know if that will be where we end up, of course. Every day things change and discoveries happen, so I don't know where we'll end up. But where we are at the moment is that our new bricks are not biodegradable, but they are made from renewable materials.
Yeah. So I always say, or often say, that when it comes to change, either the people will change or the people will change. either they're going to change from within, or they have to be cycled out. Leadership is they talk about the burden of command in leadership. Mm. There's only so much you can actually have control over, because change, you don't change people, they have to change. So what are some of the challenges that you've faced?
Well, I think it goes back to, for me, to things I learned back in G Capital in the early 90s with the change acceleration process and those things, where my eyes were open to the fact that there actually were methodologies out there, and that there were things that we could do to start to think about the way people react to change. What I've seen in the past so often is change fail, and change fail because key elements of buy-in have not been done, have not been worked on, or not taken seriously. And so I am a massive believer in finding those compelling stories that grab people and bring them with us, and actually don't bring them with us, they just want to come because what they hear is what they want to do. You might see recently on LinkedIn, I wrote a bit tongue-in-cheek about whether there really is an I in team. And what I see a lot is people launching communication campaigns and talking to large teams of people in the mistaken belief that they will therefore all follow because you've spoken to them. And the reality is that if you go all the way back to Kierkegaard, that Danish father of existentialism, what he said was that everybody comes at things from their own perspective. So if you've got 100 people in the room, you will have at least 101 perspectives going on in there. And if you've got those perspectives going on there, you need to find the stories that talk to those, and you need to understand that, which means spending a huge amount of time at the front end of change, creating that shared need, shaping your visions, mobilizing commitment around that. And if you get that piece right, and if you put that energy in, then you can change anything. You really can.
So, you really can't lead with the tool. I mean, if you're speaking to a bunch of people and you start talking about, the need for change and the need for transformation, et cetera, and then all of a sudden you start talking about Lean and Six Sigma and start speaking in Japanese, people are not going to be able to connect with you or your mission.
Exactly. But over time, they start to, because they start to understand the language. And I think almost in every project that you run, there is a language that people need to understand. That may be a technical language. It may be a change language. It could be many things. But if people don't understand that, then it just washes over them and they don't hear it and they don't understand what goes on.
Which is the importance of why.
Exactly.
It's like before you get into the lingo, before you start bombarding them with the technical jargon, which of course they have to learn. They have to learn and understand the tools, fair enough. But, the beginning starts with, why are we doing this? Why is this important?
Exactly. And we see Simon Sinek and people of his ilk now talking about that. And I'm so pleased they are, because that just resonates so strongly with me in terms of my beliefs and what I know and have seen work.
Sometimes as technologists, we assume too much.
Yeah.
I watch my youngest son try to learn German, and he learns German better from a non-native speaker that had to learn it to the point of proficiency that they could teach it, rather than a native-born German speaker.
Exactly, because they've been on the journey that he is on, right?
Right, right.
They've started from nowhere,
right?
Maybe having seen the odd German word in a film, and moving from that. And
right.
that ability to create a story and a journey for people is so, so important. And over my career, I've had some really nice opportunities to get to work with that and to practice with it, Virgin Media being a good example of it, where when you really get a great story and you really believe it and you can really articulate it with passion and with an understanding of the audience you're talking to, all of a sudden things drop into place and change happens at the speed of light. In fact, then you're in trouble, right? This is the classic Sisyphusian nightmare, right? You push the rock uphill time after time after time, then all of a sudden, actually, you make it to the top and it starts rolling down the other side and you're running as hard as your little legs will let you to keep up with it. And that's where you want to be as a change guy. That's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So what have been some of your biggest challenges? I mean, that you've either overcome or have overcome you?
I think the biggest of those challenges is always about getting started, I think. And In my past, it's about getting to the point. Sometimes you start on a journey. I'm probably not articulating this very well, but sometimes you start on a journey and you think, right, I know what I want to do. I've been recruited by companies to bring Six Sigma, for instance. And you're recruited to do that, and your boss has very high expectations. That's what you're going to do. And you go into that company. And Virgin Media was a good example of this back in the mid-2000s, when we really weren't in a great position. And you go look and you think, man, the last thing you want is Six Sigma. I've just accepted this job. I've just taken this job to be a Six Sigma lead, and we can't count. And if we can't count, we can't do Six Sigma. So you then have to really rethink it, and you have to have the strength of character to say, no, we're stopping. We need to think this through. We need to understand where we really, really are. Covey, first seek to understand, then be understood, and then move the thing forward. And it's those challenges of being brave enough to say, hold on, we're not going to go that way. We're going to find a different way, and you need to trust me for a bit, but I'll find a way of describing it for you, and then we'll move forward. And that's, I think, some of the biggest challenges. The change bit itself is not that hard. The technology bit is really easy. The process bit isn't tough. The people bit, that's the hard stuff.
You know, I've seen a lot of projects, and it seems like one of the biggest problems facing companies is that they never define what success looks like up front.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if our program is successful, how do we know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the first thing they want to do is they want to start educating and training. They want to build a bunch of green belts and a bunch of black belts.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, for what purpose? That's, you know, to me, that's almost like building inventory.
Yep.
You know, we don't want to build inventory. You know, the whole idea about lean is like continuous flow. We only build it when we need it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But people and companies think that all this training is going to miraculously improve them.
Yeah. I've actually worked in businesses where the only metric for continuous improvement was the number of green belts.
Yeah, see, it's crazy.
Which is hilarious.
Yeah. And, you know, I was speaking to an oil and gas company in the Middle East, their director of OpEx, and he'd lamented that he had, you know, trained 60 black belts and they hadn't completed a project. Now, I couldn't understand how you could be a black belt without completing a project, but that being aside, you know, this person was building capacity with no need.
Yep. And I think, so one of the things I learned, and this was one of the real, it should be obvious, right? But one of the real eye-openers to me when I was doing change acceleration stuff was a thing in GE Capital we call backward imaging. I've heard other people, Tim Smith, who did the Eden Project, describes it as telling future truths. And one of the things I do with my teams consistently is take them forward 2 years, 1 year, end of project, whatever it is, and get them to describe what it feels like, what they're seeing, what's happening around them, how is it working. But not just from a technology point of view, not just that we can process X thousand invoices a day, but what are the people doing? What are they feeling? What are they working on now? Let's describe that. Now let's work backwards and talk about how we're going to get there. That's a very, very different way from let's implement this new software.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so often businesses start from the software end.
Yeah, one of the techniques I use is I ask people to envision a newspaper that's about their program.
Exactly.
And I ask them, what would the headlines read?
Yep.
You know, and, you know, that's a...
Perfect.
Yes. Yeah, it's something that people just don't do. It's like, you know, they're so fixated on the inputs and not on the outputs. And and I think that's that, you know, that's why these programs are failing, because they don't fail to make improvements. They absolutely do. They fail to meet expectations that were never set in the first place.
Indeed. And I would question whether those improvements are actually sustainable improvements over time.
Yeah.
And whether they actually see a degradation in the results. And that's, in my experience, that's what you get when you don't get that piece right. I talk to people about, you know, envision, we're writing a book. We're writing the book of the success of the program we have in this company. What does that book look like?
Yeah.
What does the cover look like? What does the notes on the back from people who are giving us references for what they've seen, what does that look like? Now let's grab that and grab the energy that we get from that. And now let's talk about how we would get there. And as soon as you start that, as soon as people get that, it's amazing how far you can go and how fast you can get there.
So if we have some young leaders there that are you know, growing into their roles, you know, what are some of the things that you would, advise them of or caution them of?
I think the young me, given a task to implement a new system or to find productivity, would dive in there and get very, very focused on that number, on that project, on that piece of software. The current me would say, that's great, but let's look at it in the perspective of where we are today. So take some time to understand what's currently happening. Take some time to really understand the why of what's going on today and the why of where we want to go to in the future. Bottle that up, and then start your journey, because that will change the way you think about what you're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And it will give you the opportunity to bring people with you, because however brilliant you are, whatever university you went to, wherever you got your MBA, you will not deliver this on your own. And if you try to deliver it on your own, you will fail, or you will look to succeed and it will fail eventually. So take your time.
So you look down the road, not at your shoes. I hear that.
Exactly. And this is all simple stuff, right? And you can say, well, look, we've had this forever. You know, Confucius, walk in another man's shoes and all of that sort of stuff. Every journey starts with the first step and all those things. But they're there for a reason, right? Yeah. They're there because people have learned over a long period of time generally how not to do things and the mistakes they made, and we should learn from those and take the time to do that.
You know, a lot of this reminds me of the game of golf. I don't know if you play at all, but I get my money's worth out there. I was once being monitored by the CIA until they realized that it wasn't weapons of mass destruction I was talking about. It was weapons of grass reduction. And but one of the mantras in golf is hurry up and slow down.
Yeah.
Okay. So hurry up, get to your ball. Okay. But then when you're at your ball, slow it down. Think about what you're going to do. Don't rush the swing. Of course, I forget all of that by the time I get there. The intent, at least, is there.
It's really interesting, and I know when my son was younger, he played football, soccer. He's very, very good at it. But as soon as he made a mistake, his head would go down. And we had an old Irish friend, and that friend would say to him, "Tom, look, you can make mistakes. That's why pencils have rubbers, or erasers in your world." And that's an important thing to remember. It's mistakes are fine. Mistakes are part of that learning journey. If you don't learn from them, that isn't fine. But if you learn from them, that's fine. Golf is an infuriating game, and as much as I love it, it's so easy to get wrong and so hard to get right. Which keeps us coming back, right?
It's that one hole, okay? It's out of the 18 in the day, there's going to be that one hole that everything went reasonably according to plan.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that felt really great. And then, of course, the big mistake then is that we try to improve on it.
Indeed.
Okay, and it was, we have to understand that, it was an accident that it happened to us in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay, this great hole was not on purpose, because, we don't hit 500 balls a day.
Exactly.
So.
Kipling talks about treating success and failure as the same imposter. And I think that's something, it's very hard to do when you're young and impulsive, and you want to drive forward and you're trying to make a name for yourself and you're trying to show the potential that you know you have. It's very hard to do, but I think as you get older, you start to realize actually, and I can look back on life quite easily now and say, I got that wrong, but I learned, and I got this wrong and I'm still not learning, but at least I'm moving forward. And that's much easier to do with hindsight, of course, than when you're in the midst of it.
So I'm going to wrap up here with one last question, and I'll give you a moment to think about it if you need a moment, but tell me one person that you admire and why.
Only one.
Only one.
Okay. I think from a career point of view, then it would be Jack Welch. I think I was very, very lucky to be in GE at a time when he was leading, and in a time where we really knew where we were going and we really got focused. I was also very lucky to work in a business that he really enjoyed, which was the aviation services business, but also with a group of entrepreneurial people who made stuff happen. And his focus and his ability to bring change to a business and to get that business focused has made such an impact on my working life. And I often think back to those days and think how much I learned through that period of time. And so I thank him very much. Excellent. On a regular basis for where I am today.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Peter. Peter Evans, Continuous Improvement Director at LEGO. Thank you, everybody.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.